Now, have you tried eating finger limes? Because they come in a range of colours and tartness out of those rainforests on the border between New South Wales and Queensland. And like the macadamia nut, we had to see the Americans making a buck out of our indigenous food before we started getting excited. Now, finger limes have been branded citrus caviar, and I travelled to Brisbane to spread them on fish and a dessert. We'll also head to Tasmania for some tips on preserving excess bounty with Sally Wise, and the response to our program on biofortifying food using GM has been extraordinary. But let's begin somewhere else.
Be aware of food allergies that your customers may suffer from.
Health authorities have shut down a Melbourne restaurant over a salmonella scare.
Severe food poisoning struck down three actors.
As a food business, you need to make sure you serve food that is
safe. Authorities were alerted after two people ended up in hospital.
They became so ill they were bedridden. Two were hospitalised.
And it was found that the only common link between them was that they had eaten at this restaurant.
At present, there is nothing that says that somebody who buys a food business or opens a food business has to have gone through any sort of training at all before they open that business.
John Fallon is a food safety auditor at risk assessment and training company SAI Global. And at an industry conference in Sydney, John bemoaned the lack of emphasis on food safety in Australia, both in the serving and the processing.
They may have no knowledge of what the biological hazards are, what the physical hazards are, what some of the chemical hazards are that could get into the food through their production process.
There's roughly 5.4 million cases of food poisoning annually in Australia, and they're the ones that have been reported. And of course, many of those are due to poor practices in our own homes. Even so, John Fallon believes that in a day and age when more and more hands are involved in producing food than ever before, the manufacturing and hospitality industries need to take a more active role.
We've gone from the day where we grew our fruit and veggies in the backyard to now having quite a number of different people involved in the process. So the food's handled a lot more.
And when it comes to any issues surrounding food safety, who governs the legislation in Australia?
That's very hard to answer. There's every level of government has a role in it. So local councils, state governments, federal government, etc. And it becomes very, very difficult for food manufacturers and even the retailers to understand what are the actual requirements, because there's different interpretation of sometimes the same legislation.
So if I walk into an eatery of any kind and have an adverse reaction to something I've ordered there, who do I contact?
In most cases, you would go first to your local council, and if they can't handle it or don't know what to do, then you would take it to your state regulator for food.
But local councils all have food inspectors, don't they?
No, not exactly. Most of them have environmental health officers. Now, those people can be taking on roles such as inspecting pools, inspecting fences, overhanging trees, dogs barking, even brothel inspections in some states. They're not necessarily just there looking at food, or they might not even have any officers in that council jurisdiction that do anything with food at all.
So are you saying that in some cases there might be someone who's a whiz at inspecting pool fences who's then called upon to act as an inspector of a premises where there's been allegations made of food poisoning?
That's correct.
And they may have no training in that area at all?
That's correct.
Well, that's just an explosion waiting to happen, isn't it?
To a degree, if the council doesn't have that level of expertise on board, then they would go to a state level and get somebody from the state regulator to come on and assist them with the investigation. So in the vast majority of cases, the local councils are just going to report through any adverse health findings to the state regulator, and then the state regulator would take over from there.
But John, I take it from how you're talking about this that if there's those kind of protocols in place where you refer up, that takes time.
Not necessarily. They've now got really good communication processes in place for those public health issues as such. It's more to do with the actual inspection of the facility. So it's generally up to the consumer to make a complaint before somebody knows that the facility is potentially going to put people at risk.
Okay, so you're saying that there's not enough proactive inspection going on, but once a complaint is made, then all the processes spring into place.
That's correct. People still have this expectation that the government and the council is responsible for keeping people safe. But the legislation's quite clear that it's the responsibility of the food premises to have the skills and knowledge necessary. And that tends to be where the facilities are lacking.
Are you therefore saying that we need some kind of compulsory induction training when new food businesses open up?
That would be the way to go. A lot of the state regulators have food safety supervisor courses, which in some cases are mandated. But that only means that one person from that facility has to have gone and done a course. So the business owner might just send their kitchen hand along so they've got that piece of paper signed off to meet the regulatory requirement. And then they come back into the food business and they're just made to go and wash up dishes again.
So that box has been ticked and on we go.
Box has been ticked and on we go.
I must say, as a person who likes to eat food, and as many of us in Australia who go out to eat food every day of our lives, it sounds in some cases like we're walking a tightrope, hoping that the people we put our trust in are doing the right thing.
Absolutely correct.
Let's talk about the Garibaldi case in South Australia of some years ago. Just remind people of what happened there.
That went back to about 95, I believe, where there was an outbreak of E. coli.
23 victims who were poisoned by contaminated meatwurst in 1995 have now reached settlements. It marks the end of one of the state's longest-running legal battles.
And that resulted in not only tragedy and loss of life and damage in some cases of a semi-permanent nature to the people who ate that poisoned preserved meat, but also the company, of course, collapsed, didn't it?
That's correct, yes.
Most of the victims were children, including 4-year-old Nikki Robinson, who died just days after eating the meatwurst. Dylan Patterson was just 5 months old when he became ill. 5 years ago, he was forced to have a kidney transplant. He's just one of a number of people who became sick after eating small goods contaminated with E. coli bacteria.
So if I'm an owner of an eatery that's found culpable for food poisoning, what kind of penalties can I face?
You can be prosecuted. You are most likely just to lose your business because customers just won't go there. But the ultimate could be jail term, depending on the state that you're in and the offence.
Each of the victims has now received a compensation payout from the insurance company QBE, and the state government has promised to cover the cost of any ongoing medical treatment. Lucas Fonten, ABC News, Adelaide.
You're with Michael McKenzie on RN First Bite, and we're talking food safety with John Fallon. And John, let's talk now about allergies. If I have a nut allergy and I go to a restaurant that has a large sign on the front that says we're nut free, and then I go into anaphylactic shock as a result of eating a meal containing nuts, what happens to that restaurant owner?
They would be prosecuted. They have a legal responsibility to ensure that they supply a product that meets the customer's demand when it comes to allergens. So if the customer goes into the facility and asks them, does this product have peanuts in it, it's their obligation to tell them either yes, it does, or no, it doesn't, or that they cannot guarantee that it is peanut-free.
And the same would go for milk products or products containing gluten, anything where there may be allergic reactions?
That's correct, yes.
So the owner, no matter whether they shopped for an ingredient that may contain these allergens and then combine it with things they knew about, they're still culpable, are they?
That's correct, yes.
What about labelling of food when it comes to this?
The labelling laws in Australia are quite good. The difficulty comes that a lot of food manufacturers don't understand the legislation. And that's why we're having a lot of recalls at the moment due to undeclared allergens on product, because they're just not understanding that they have to put that onto the label.
Well, John, is there any tips you can give us so we can avoid learning the hard way that a restaurant or food outlet is doing the wrong thing?
No, not really. There's nothing that stands out to say that one place is better than the other. Most premises you don't see where the food is being prepared, so it's very difficult. But obviously, if you walk into a restaurant and the service area is unclean, then yeah, perhaps the kitchen's even worse than the service area.
Does it give you pause for thought knowing all this when you go and eat out?
At times, yes.
And does it necessarily follow that the more you pay for food, the safer the food will be?
Oh, absolutely not. No, not at all. Price is not a barrier to food safety.
Well, on that rather scary bombshell, John Fallon, thank you for joining us on RN First Bite.
Thank you so much.
If you go to our website, I'll be posting links to regulations and the channels for complaint around food safety. And while you're there, if you've had any experiences yourself with food poisoning, incorrect labelling, or the complaints process, we'd love to hear about it. One proviso, please do not name names. abc.net.au/rn and look for RN First Bite on the right-hand side. Now, instead of letting fresh food go off in either your fridge or the fruit bowl, what about preserving it for another time? From Tasmania, cook, writer and farmer, Sally Wise.
My husband was an ardent fan of preserving, having worked on a farm for many years, and he bought me a book called Home Preserving by Joan Robins. It was a bit of an epiphany for me. In America, they call bottling canning. Always have done and do to this day. So in this book was this comment, eat what you can and can what you can't. My goodness, that is so true. You should make the most of seasonal fruit. You can only eat so much jam. And so I began preserving in earnest. And it's a funny thing that once you have a preserver and once people know you have a passion for preserving, they bring you all sorts of seasonal fruits. We had the luxury of experimentation. But that's enough about me. It's time to talk about how to go about doing this bottling. Well, of course, you're going to need the right equipment. Do you need a preserving outfit? Well, technically, no. You can do the same thing in a pot on the top of the stove, but it's made so much simpler if you do have one. For a long time, a fowler's outfit was the only one that you could purchase. We still use, for instance, an old battered version sometimes that we sit on top of an old fuel stove. You need jars. You can get pretty jars or plain, the old fowler's jars. There's such a variety today. Same with the lids, flip-top, clip-top, and screw-topped, all sorts. You just choose what suits you best. You just need to add fruit. Fruit for bottling is best when it's just ripe because it looks best in the bottle then. It holds its shape really well. And then if you have stone fruits such as apricots or peaches, you're going to need to take the stones out. Place those halves neatly in the jar, packed as tight as you can, and cut side down. Then you're going to need some sort of preserving liquid in there. Generally, you use a sugar syrup, anything from equal parts sugar to water, right back to much lighter than that. Some people don't like to use sugar at all. You can use honey, though be sparing with that because it's much sweeter than sugar. Whatever you use, fill the jar to the brim, and if it's a screw-top jar, screw the lid down tight and then release it just a smidgen. So now place your jars in the preserver and fill the preserver up to the bottom of the lids with cold water. Then set your temperature. Now, it's going to take about 50 minutes to bring that temperature up to that level, and it's really important it takes that long because you need the core of the fruit in the centre of the bottle to reach that temperature, not just the outer. Then hold it at that temperature for the required amount of time, and then you're ready to lift them out. Now, if you've used screw-top jars, now's the time to screw those lids down tightly, but be very careful when you do that because a little bit of hot liquid might come out. Be careful you don't burn yourself. Many people will preserve at around 92 degrees and vary the time according to the size of the jars. For me personally, over the years I've had the luxury of working out what is the best temperature for the best fruit. And so, for instance, I will do apricots at 88 degrees Celsius and I will do apple quarters or slices at 80 degrees and apple puree I'll do at 85. It's just a matter of working out what is best. You have now at your fingertips a tapestry of colour and flavour that you can pluck out and use any time of the year. And you can make an apricot crumble in the middle of winter when you serve it to guests. It reminds them of the summer past and the one that's going to come. I think it's one of the best ways of all to preserve seasonal fruits.
If you missed some of the details in Sally's preservation techniques, just head to RN First Bite online and you'll find all the info there. And while you're foraging, can I suggest you drop into last week's special program on whether we should use GM technology to biofortify staple crops in developing countries where malnutrition is rife.
Frankenstein seed, killer tomato, Terminator seed. These are all borrowed from scary Hollywood movies and are based on fiction. There's no truth to those movies. They were fantasies. And yet it makes GM seem scary, when in fact GM is friendly. And so friendly, in fact, that it can save 2 million people from dying every year with one genetic modification.
They want to be able to have a poster child to say that genetic engineering can help produce a crop that's more nutritious. Because when we look globally at genetic engineering, the vast majority of the traits when you look at global acreage is herbicide tolerance.
Both the program itself and the feature article that went with it provoked strong reactions, both for and against, and occasionally pretty robust debate between individual contributors in our audience. Opinions ranged from GM food science being unproven, unnecessary, and dangerous to food systems, through to calls for GM fortified foods like golden rice, bananas, and potatoes being allowed to do the job they were designed to, that is, save millions of lives in countries where local diets are poor in vitamin A, zinc, and iron. We were also criticised for not using more local spokespeople in the case against GM biofortification. If you missed the show last week, it's available for download via the website or iTunes, and the comments section is still open for you to add your voice. Feel free to wade into the debate. All I ask is you keep it nice. You're with RN First Bite.
I said, we've got one of these, which I hadn't been brave enough to eat. It said a native of Australia on the tree. And I just thought, I'm not going to eat those. Could be poisonous. So we'd never, ever even tried the ones we had.
Margie Douglas and her husband Ian live in rainforest on the New South Wales-Queensland border. And what Margie hadn't dared taste is Citrus australasica, better known as the finger lime. So, Margie, when you found out that these things were, in fact, not poison, tell me about that first experience of, you know, tentatively opening the skin.
Well, my brother tried them and said, yum. And
So you asked other members of your family to experiment first. Yeah, you put them forward. That's very good of you.
My brother was visiting at the time and couldn't resist and picked it and tasted it. And he said, you know, oh, they're great, you know, yum. And, you know, of course, from there we just ordered trees, but we had to wait probably a couple of years before we could even get the trees. Mm. And so we now have 4,000 trees in of various varieties.
You have a personal relationship with suppliers. You treat them like family, and then you treat these finger limes like your babies. You just have this brain burst, I call it, and all of a sudden you're coming up with a whole lot of new and different ways of utilising the product.
David Pugh is the chef and owner of Restaurant 2 in Brisbane, and he's been using finger limes in his food for years. But when Margie and Ian said they'd like him to try their crop, he was hooked. So if you haven't tried it, what is it about this native citrus with the leathery skin?
It's a citrus burst. I liken it to when you have a really good bead of caviar. Here you have a really good bead of finger lime, and you crush it on the roof of your mouth or bite into it with your teeth.
It's like a citrus hand grenade.
Yeah, pretty much.
People don't really understand them at this stage, but slowly people are buying them singly and in twos, paying a lot of money for them.
Which you must be devastated about. You know, you must be gutted, aren't
you? Very unhappy about that.
Yeah.
But they keep on coming back and buying them. These places sell them fresh during the season, and then they sell them frozen during the off-season.
Ian and Margie Douglas supply these little citrus grenades to high-end restaurants around the country, and they export them fresh into Europe and frozen into Japan. Russia has also been clamouring for them, but just as the first shipment of finger limes was due to fly, in comes Australian trade sanctions against the Putin government. Yes, it affects everybody. Well, let's go into the kitchen and see what you could do with the ones that have arrived today. David, if that's all right?
Yeah.
I'll grab my camera.
We know for certain that Aboriginal tribes in areas where they grew in the wild used them for many, many years for both food reasons, I guess, but also, I think, probably for health reasons because they're full of vitamin C and very high in antioxidants, I think even higher than blueberries.
Margie's just split open one of the ones they brought. She's squeezing out this citrus caviar. And the smell, that's for me.
Yeah.
So David's offering me a little spoon of the innards of this?
Byron Sunrise.
This is the Byron Sunrise. So this is the one with the very pink pearls. Wow.
Addictive.
Yeah. Golly, it's just grabbed me and shaken me and thrown me to the floor. That's quite tart.
Yep. That one's mild.
That's mild, isn't it? Oh, okay. Mm.
Yeah, it is.
And here's me making a song and dance about it.
Mm. Yeah. Put it in your gin and tonic, in margarita.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of barramundi. The wild barramundi's in season, and tiger prawns are just coming into season now, and there's just three swarthy brutes there that thought we might cook off.
So this is a classic case in point of that citrus tartness going with seafood so wonderfully, yeah?
Yeah, it is, and it's a pretty sensual-looking thing when you see these bright colours and you go, what does it hold in store for me?
Yes.
And then when you crunch into it and you just go, wow, it's just a revelation.
Yeah, it really delivers.
I think that is the amazing part.
Well, those prawns and that barra's smelling fantastically.
So
it does.
People need to know how to look after them. They can be a bit temperamental. If you refrigerate them, take them out, leave them in the sun, they don't like temperature change a whole lot. When we pick one day, we pack the next day, and then we either post or deliver the following day. So the turnaround's very quick, and that's right direct from the farm.
So overseas, Japan, Europe wanting them, but I understand from what I was reading that the US says no, you can't import.
Yes,
But
yes.
They've got their own stock growing over in California, I think.
They do.
Yeah.
A little inferior to ours, if I may say so, but never mind. I'm allowed to say that.
But there's a real problem with that. The history of the macadamia is that the macadamia was a Queensland tree. It ended up being grown largely in Hawaii. The truth of the matter is that there are finger lime trees going overseas even now. And we run the risk of the same thing happening to finger limes as happened to macadamias.
But don't we deserve that? If we don't recognise what we have in this country, and other countries do, then all the best to them.
Of course we do. I mean, that's right. And governments are not quick enough on their feet to protect the growing of products like the finger lime. Mm. We have the similar problems in Australia. For instance, to send fresh finger limes out of Queensland to Western Australia, and we send them to Margaret River, we have to have them inspected by biosecurity in Queensland at a very high cost before they're packed and before they're sent to Western Australia. So the same situation applies if we want to send them fresh into South Australia or Tasmania. It makes it very difficult for growers to actually provide a product domestically that's good quality to chefs all around the country.
So is there less rigorous inspection of your finger limes going to some overseas countries than there are interstate in Australia?
Yeah, we can send them into Hong Kong and, say, Dubai without any inspection whatsoever. It's more difficult to send them into South Australia than it is to send them to Hong Kong.
David, how are you going? Good. You've chosen the finger lime of your desires?
Yes.
Why this one?
It's got a little bit more, a little bit more punch, smell, and it's
wow. It's
got a better release. Yeah, I will save the.
Got it. That's incredible.
Save this beautiful pink bead for the dessert.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'll be better. And this one's got a lot of punch, and it'll be great with the seafood.
Mm.
Great for the seafood. Beautiful release.
What you're doing now is that's a totally different pigmentation again.
You find that. No two are going to be, they're like humans. No two are going to be 100% all the same.
So fingerprints?
Pretty much. Yeah.
They find them in the rainforest. And, you know, people that do the growing and the grafting of them will go into the rainforest and just take pieces and then graft them on, and so it goes. There's about, I think, 70-odd different varieties of finger limes. There are some that are just so overpowering that, you know, you wouldn't be growing them.
The flavour is so tart.
Some of them are, you know, very, very, very strong.
All right, here comes David now with the barramundi and the prawns.
Okay, so
do you tend to err on the side of caution or not?
No, greed.
Greed is good.
You only have one life.
Unless, of course, you're a believer in a higher being, David, in which case there might be finger limes in heaven.
Yeah, there might be.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
So, David, just remind me, what am I putting in my mouth here?
Okay, well, you've got some torn coriander, salad, onions, daikon, green pawpaw, a little bit of citrus dressing, and you've got a lot of beet on there. You're going to get a real hit. And so I'd follow that really quickly with a tiger prawn.
All right.
And good tip. That'll be beautiful.
All right, here we go. Oh, wow. It's a combination of the prawn and the finger lime together, the Byron Sunrise, is doing my mouth in. It's fantastic. Yeah. Margie, you're happy with what David's done here? You can speak with your mouthful.
Delicious with my mouthful. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
For dessert, we've got creme brulee and...
creme brulee, budrum ginger.
Is that macadamias in there too?
Yeah, a little bit of macadamia. Vanilla beans from the Dane tree. We've got the finger limes just to piece the resistance. Doesn't get any better.
David, Margie, Ian... thank you very much for a journey into the story of finger limes, and may they take over the world. Thank you.
Have a good idea.
Thank you.
As I speak, finger limes are being eaten in Singapore, Dubai, Spain, Germany, Belgium, the UK, not to mention Japan and Russia, if the sanctions are ever lifted. And if you'd like a squiz at the innards of these elongated sacks of tartness, I've put photos up of the fruit and the dishes prepared by David Pugh. There'll be links to recipes and history up there as well on the website. RN First Bite is produced by Kathy Pryor, finessed by Matthew Sigley, and kicked around the yard by me. Next time, Australia's first families of wine, all 12 of them, sit down to compare notes and tell tall stories about vines, history, rare drops, and why the next generation of makers may well be daughters. I'm Michael McKenzie. I'll catch you soon.